usually penetrating mind when he was in the mood, and he knew Jamie Fraser quite well. On the other hand, there were things in John's own relationship, such as it was, with Jamie Fraser that he would just as soon not have his brother penetrate. "I meant to be meeting Prévost and his staff in half an hour, and you're meant to be with me, didn't I tell you?" "No." "Is my function purely ornamental, or shall I go armed?" "Armed? Prévost wants to discuss bringing Maitland's troops up from Beaufort," Hal said. "You expect this discussion to be acrimonious?" "No, but I may add my own bit of acrimony to the meeting. I don't like the men sitting about here with nothing to occupy them save drink and the local whores." "Oh." John felt a momentary tightness in his chest at mention of whores, but Hal's face showed no sign that the word had brought Jane Pocock to mind. John dug his dagger, pistol, and shot pouch out of his chest and laid them on the bed, next to his clean white stockings. "Very well, then." He dressed, more or less efficiently, and handed Hal his leather stock, turning round so his brother could fasten it at the back. His hair hadn't yet grown past his shoulders. Hal brushed the stubby tail that passed for a queue irritably aside. "Haven't you found a new valet yet?"
"Haven't time to train one."
He could feel Hal's warm breath and cool fingers on the back of his neck, and found the touch soothing.
"What's keeping you so busy?"
Hal's voice was sharp.
He was under strain. "Your daughter-in-law, my son, my presumed son, your son, and you know minor bits of regimental business."
He turned round to face Hal, dropping the chain of his gorget over his head. Hal had the grace to look slightly abashed, though he snorted.
"You need a valet. I'll find you one. Come on."
Prévost's headquarters were in a large mansion on the edge of St. James's Square, no more than a 10-minute walk, and the day was fine. It was warm and sunny, with a light breeze blowing toward the sea, and it was also market day. The brothers Grey made their way along Bay Street toward the city market, through a throng of people and the bracing smells of vegetables and fresh fish.
"Here's a question for you," John said, dodging a woman with a tray of dripping oysters suspended from her neck and a bucket of beer in each hand. "You know Jamie Fraser. Do you think he'd be susceptible to money?"
Hal frowned.
"In what way? Everyone's susceptible to money under the right circumstances. I assume you don't mean bribery."
"No. In fact, I'm concerned that what I'm proposing to him shouldn't strike him as bribery." Hal's brows went up in surprise.
"What the devil do you want him to do?"
"Give his assent and encouragement to the idea of his daughter coming to Savannah in order to paint a portrait. I've said I'd make sure she's decently paid for it, but I..."
"A portrait of you?"
Hal gave him an amused glance.
"I'd like to see it."
"A present for Mother, or are you courting?" "I hadn't had either of those prospects in mind. The portrait isn't to be of me in any case. Alfred Brumby wants a picture made of his new wife." Hal grinned.
"The fair Angelina."
John smiled too. Young Mrs. Brumby was good-looking, but there was something about her that simply made people want to laugh.
"If anyone is capable of capturing Mrs. Brumby's ineffable nature on canvas, it might be Brianna Mackenzie. But that's not why you want to lure the young woman out of her eyrie, is it? There must be other portrait painters in the colony of Georgia, surely."
They were approaching Prévost's headquarters. The shouts and measured thuds of drilling came faintly through the morning mist from the open ground at the end of Jones Street. Redcoats were beginning to thicken in the crowd of people thronging up Montgomery Street.
"You mistake my purpose," John said,
turning sideways to allow a hurrying lady with wide panniers, a parasol, two servants, and a small dog to pass him.
"Your pardon, madam." "And I hope Jamie Fraser does as well."
Sal glanced sharply at him, but was prevented from speaking by the passage of two tanner's lads, scarves wrapped round their faces, and carrying an enormous basket between them, from which the eye-watering reek of dog ordure emerged like an evil gin. Hal apparently had got a lungful of the stuff and coughed until his eyes watered. John eyed him. His brother was prone to attacks of wheezing and shortness of breath. In this instance, though, he got control of himself, spat several times, pounded his chest with a fist, and shook himself, breathing heavily.
"What purpose?" he said. "I mentioned my son. Brianna Fraser is William's half-sister."
"Oh, so she would be.
I hadn't thought of that."
Hal adjusted his hat, disarranged by the coughing fit.
"He's not met her."
"Briefly, a few years ago, but he had no notion who she was.
I know the young woman quite well, however, and while she is quite as obstinate as either one of her parents, she has a kind heart. She would be curious about her brother, and if there's anyone who could talk sensibly to him about his difficulties, it would likely be her."
"Hmm."
Hal considered that for a few steps. "Are you sure that's wise? If she's Fraser's daughter... Wait, you said both her parents. Is she also Claire Fraser's daughter?"
"She is," John said, in a tone indicating that this was probably all his brother required to know about Brianna. Apparently it was, for Hal laughed.
"She may persuade him to turn his coat and fight for the rebels, might she not?" "If there's one trait that Jamie Fraser has succeeded in passing to all his offspring," John said dryly, "it's stubbornness. Forceful as she is, I doubt she could persuade William of anything whatever."
"Then I want him to stay," John blurted.
"Here, at least until he's made up his mind about everything."
Everything, encompassing William's paternity, his career with the army, his title, and the estate to whose control he had just ascended, having reached his majority.
"Oh."
Hal stopped dead, looking at his brother, then glanced down the street. Prevost's headquarters stood at the far corner, a large grey house, with the normal trickle of officers and civilians going in and out under the eyes of the two soldiers guarding the door. Hal took John's arm and pulled him into the side street, less crowded. John's heart was thumping. He hadn't articulated his fears even to himself, but the letter to Jamie had brought them clearly to the surface of his mind. Hal looked at him, one dark brow arched. John closed his eyes and took a breath, deep enough to keep his voice level.
"I have dreams," he said. "Not every night. Often, though. Of William."
It wasn't a question, but John nodded and opened his eyes. Hal's face was attentive, his eyes direct and bloodshot.
"Dead?" Hal asked. "Lost?"
John nodded again, wordless. He cleared his throat, though, and found a few.
"Isabel told me that he was lost once, at Hellwater, when he was 3 or so, wandering alone in a fog on the fells. Sometimes I see that. Sometimes other things."
William had always told him stories, written him letters, of being trapped in Quebec during a long, cold winter, hunting, lost overnight, feet freezing, the eerie light of the Arctic sky thrumming overhead, falling through ice into dark water. To William, this was mere adventure, and John enjoyed hearing about it. But in the dark of his dreams, such things came back twisted, cold as ghosts, and filled with foreboding.
"And battle,"
Hal said, almost under his breath. He was leaning back against the brick wall of a tavern, his eyes on the polished toes of his boots.
"Yes, you see those things when you're a father, even when you're not asleep."
John nodded, but didn't say anything. He felt a bit better to have spoken.
Of course Hal thought such things. Henry, badly wounded in battle, and Benjamin.
He thought of William digging up a grave in the dark, expecting to find his cousin's body. He dreamed of digging up a grave himself and finding William in it. Hal heaved a sigh and straightened up.
"Tell Fraser that William is here," he said quietly. "Just mention it casually, nothing more. He'll send the girl."
"You think so?"
Hal glanced at him and took his elbow, steering him out of the alley.
"You think he cares less about William than you do?"
Chapter 42 Sassenach, Clan na Gaelic. Jamie read the letter through twice, his lips tightening at the same place, halfway down the first page, and then again at the end. It wasn't actually unusual for him to react to one of John's letters that way, but when he did, it was normally because it held unwelcome news of the war, of William, or of some incipient action on the part of the British government that might be about to result in Jamie's imminent arrest, or some other domestic inconvenience. This, however, was the first letter John had sent in nearly 2 years, since before Jamie's return from the dead, to find me married to John Gray, and before he had punched John in the eye as a result of this news, and inadvertently caused his lordship to be arrested and nearly hanged by the American militia. Well, turnabout was fair play, I supposed. No point in putting it off. "What does John have to say?" I asked, keeping my voice pleasantly neutral. Jamie glanced up at me, snorted, and took off his spectacles.
"He wants Vienna," he said shortly,
and pushed the letter across the table to me. I glanced involuntarily over my shoulder, but Bree had gone to the spring house with a box of freshly made goat's cheeses. I pulled my spectacles out of my pocket. "I take it you noticed that last bit," I said, glancing up when I'd finished reading.
"My son William has resigned his commission and is presently staying with me in Savannah, making use of his newfound leisure to contemplate his future, as he has now attained his majority. I did."
He glared at the letter, then at me.
"Contemplate his future? What is there to contemplate, for God's sake? He's an earl."
"Maybe he doesn't want to be an earl," I said mildly.
"It's not something you've got a choice about, Sassenach," he said. "It's like a birthmark. You're born with it."
He was frowning down at the letter, lips tight. I gave him an exasperated look, which he sensed, for he glanced up and raised his brows at me.
"What are you giving me that sort of look for?" he demanded. "It's not my
He stopped, almost in time. "Well, let's not say fault. Nobody's blaming you, but..."
"Nobody but William. He's blaming me."
He exhaled through his nose, then took a breath and shook his head.
"And no without reason.
See,
this is why I didn't want Brianna telling him. If he'd never seen me, nor found out the truth, he'd be in England right now, taking care of his lands and tenants, happy as a..."
He stopped, groping. "Clam," I suggested. "What makes you think he isn't happy at the moment? Perhaps he just hasn't been able to arrange passage back to England yet."
"Clam?"
He looked at me for an instant, brows raised, then dismissed all clams with an abrupt gesture.
"I wouldn't be happy in his position, and I didn't see how an honourable man could be."
"Well, he is very like you." I was hoping to keep the conversation focused on William and avoid notice of John, but I should have known that was futile. He snatched up the letter, crumpled it, and threw it into the fire with a very rude Gaelic expression.
"Machna gala. First he takes my son, then he swives my wife, and now he's trying to suborn my daughter."
"Oh, he is not." I'd been keeping a lid on my own temper, but the flames of rage curling round the edges of the room were getting too warm. I was growing brown and crispy. "He just wants Bree to go and talk to her brother,"
Can't you see that, you bloody Scot?
That stopped him for an instant, and I saw a startled spark of amusement in his eyes, though it didn't reach his mouth. He did breathe, though. That was an improvement.
Talk to her brother,
he repeated. Why?
Does he think Brianna will sing my praises to such an extent that William will forget that I'm the reason he's a bastard? And even if he decided to forgive me for that, it wouldn't help him settle his mind to be an earl.
He snorted.
Left to the influence of that den of sneaks, I'd no be surprised if Brianna ended up sailing off to England with them to paint portraits of the Queen.
I have no idea what John thinks, I said evenly. But since he says, contemplate his future, I assume that he means William has doubts. Brianna is an outsider in this. She'd have a different perspective on things. She could listen without getting personally involved.
Ha, he said. That lassie is personally involved in every damn thing she touches. She gets it from you,
he added, with an accusing look at me. And she doesn't give up on anything she's made up her mind to do, I said, settling back in my chair and folding my hands in my lap. She gets that from you.
Thank you.
It wasn't necessarily a compliment.
That did get the breath of a laugh, though he stayed on his feet. He'd gone the colour of the tomatoes in my garden at the height of his speech, but this was fading back to his normal ruddy bronze. I relaxed a little, too, and took a breath.
You know one thing about John, though?
I ken a number of things about him, most of which I wish I didn't.
Which one thing do you mean?
He knows your daughter loves you, and that no matter what she and William have to say to each other, that will be part of the conversation.
He blinked, disconcerted. Maybe, but...
Do you think he cares for William any less than you do? The atmosphere had cooled, and I could feel my heart rate slowing down. Jamie had turned his back and was leaning on the mantelpiece, looking into the fire. The letter had burned, but was still visible, a curled black leaf on the hearth. The fingers of his right hand tapped slowly against the stone. At last he sighed and turned round.
I'll talk to Brianna, he said.
Did you talk to Brianna yet? I asked the next day.
I will, he said with some reluctance. But I'm no going to tell her about William.
I was sniffing cautiously at the stew I'd made for dinner, but desisted in order to look sideways at him. Why on earth not?
Because if I did, she'd go because she thought I wanted her to, even if she otherwise wouldn't go at all.
That was probably true, though I personally didn't see anything wrong with asking her to do something Jamie wanted done. He plainly did, though, so I nodded agreeably and held out the spoon to him. Taste that, will you, and tell me if you think it's fit for human consumption?
He paused, spoon halfway to his mouth.
What's in it?
I was hoping you could tell me. I think it might possibly be venison, but Mrs. MacDonald didn't know for sure. Her husband came home with it from a trip to the Cherokee villages, and it didn't have any skin on it, and he said he'd been too drunk when he won it in a dice game to have asked. Eyebrows raised as high as they'd go, he sniffed gingerly, blew on the spoonful of hot stew, then licked up a small taste, closing his eyes like a French dégustateur, judging the virtues of a new roan.
He said.
He lapped a little more, though, which was encouraging, and finally took a whole bite, which he chewed slowly, eyes still closed in concentration. Finally he swallowed, and, opening his eyes, said,
It needs pepper, and maybe vinegar.
For taste or disinfection? I asked. I glanced at the pie safe, wondering whether I could scrabble together sufficient remnants from its contents for a substitute dinner.
Taste, he said, leaning past me to dip the spoon again. It's wholesome enough, though. I think it's wapiti, and meat from a very old tough buck. "Is it not Mrs. MacDonald who thinks you're a witch?"
"Well, if she does, she kept it to herself when she brought me her youngest son yesterday with a broken leg. The older son brought the meat this morning. It was quite a large chunk of meat, regardless of origin. I put the rest in the smokehouse, but it smelled a little odd."
"What smells odd?"
The back door opened and Brianna came in, carrying a small pumpkin, Roger behind her with a basket of collard greens from the garden. I raised a brow at the pumpkin, too small for pie-making and very much too green, and she shrugged. "A rat or something was gnawing on it when we went into the garden." She turned it to display fresh tooth marks. "I knew it would go bad right away if we left it, if the rat didn't come right back and finish it off. So we brought it in."
"Well, I've heard of fried green pumpkin," I said, dubiously accepting the gift. "This is already rather an experimental meal, after all."
Brianna looked at the hearth and took a deep, cautious sniff.
"It smells edible," she said.
"Aye, that's what I said," Jamie said, waving aside the possibility of wholesale ptomaine poisoning with one hand. "Sit down, lass. Lord John sent me a wee letter, and he's mentioning you."
"Lord John?"
One red brow arched and her face lighted up. "What does he want?" Jamie stared at her.
"Why would you think he wants something from you?"
he asked, wary but curious. Brianna swept her skirt to one side and sat down, pumpkin still in one hand, and extended a hand to Jamie, palm up.
"Lend me your dirk for a minute, Dar. As for Lord John, he doesn't do social chat. I don't know whether he wants something from me, but I've read enough of his letters to know that he doesn't bother writing unless he's got a purpose."
I snorted slightly and exchanged a look with Jamie. That was completely true. Granted, his purpose was occasionally just to warn Jamie that he was risking his head, his neck, or his balls in whatever rash venture John thought he might be involved in, but it definitely was a purpose. Bree took the proffered dirk and began to slice the small pumpkin, spilling glistening clumps of tangled green seeds onto the table.
"So?" she said, eyes on her work.
"So,"
Jamie said, and took a deep breath. The fried green pumpkin was indeed edible, though I wouldn't say much more for it than that.
"Needs ketchup," was Jemmy's comment.
"Aye," his grandfather agreed, chewing gingerly. "Walnut ketchup, maybe, or mushroom."
"Walnut ketchup?"
Jemmy and Amanda burst into giggles, but Jamie merely eyed them tolerantly.
"Aye, you wee ignoramuses," he said. "Ketchup's any relish you put on your meat or vegetables. Notice that tomato mash your mum makes for you."
"What does walnut ketchup taste like?" Jem demanded.
"Walnuts," Jamie said unhelpfully, "with vinegar and anchovies and a few other things. Hush now. I want to be speaking with your mother."
While the children and I cleared the table, Jamie laid out Lord John's proposal in detail for Brianna. Careful, I noted, to keep his own feelings out of the matter.
"It can take a bit of time to think, Ian," he said, finishing up, "but it's growing late in the year for a long journey. If you go, you may well not be able to come back until the spring."
Brianna and Roger exchanged a long look, and I felt a twinge of the heart.
I hadn't thought of that, but he was right.
Snow-choked passes cut off the high mountains from the low country as effectively as a 1,000-foot stone wall. Brianna was nodding, though.
"We'll do it," she said simply.
"We?"
said Roger, but he smiled.
"Are you sure?"
Jamie asked, and I saw the fingers of his right hand flutter briefly at the edge of the table.
"If you're going to buy a lot of guns, you probably need to get your golden whiskey to the coast,"
Bree pointed out reasonably. "Lord John's offering me an assured safe conduct pass, and armed escort, if I want it, which I don't, to go there. She lifted a shoulder. What could be easier? Jamie lifted a brow. So did Roger.
What? She demanded, looking from one to the other. Jamie made a slight Scottish noise and looked away. Roger drew a deep breath as though about to speak, then let it out again.
You're thinking of hiding 6 casks of whiskey and £500 in gold in your wee box of paints?
Jamie said.
Under the noses of your armed guards, Roger added, who will presumably be British soldiers, charged, among other things, with the arrest of...
Moonshiners, I said.
Jamie raised his other brow.
Really? I said. The notion being that people with illegal stills operate them largely at night, I suppose. Well, I do have a plan, Brianna said with some asperity.
I'm going to take the kids with me.
Wow, said Jimmy.
Amanda, having no idea what was being discussed, loyally chirped,
Wow,
as well, which made Fanny and Germain laugh. Jamie said something under his breath in Gaelic. Roger didn't say it, but might as well have had the words, God help us all, tattooed on his forehead. I felt similarly, but for once I thought I'd concealed my sentiments better than the men who weren't trying to conceal theirs at all. I wiped my face with a towel and started slicing the apple and raisin pie for dessert.
Possibly there are a few refinements that could be added, I said, as soothingly as possible, my back safely turned. Why don't we talk about it when the children are in bed?
We'd shooed all the children upstairs to bed, and Jamie had brought down a bottle of the JFS. Aged 7 years in sherry casks, it may not have been quite worth its weight in gold, but it was still an invaluable aid to conferences with a strong potential for going sideways. He poured each of us a large tot, and sitting down himself, raised a hand for silence while he took a mouthful, held it for a long moment, then swallowed and sighed.
All right, he said, lowering his hand. What is it you have in mind, then, Munian Ruai?
Roger gave a mild snort of amusement at hearing him call Brianna my red-haired lass, and I smiled into my whisky. It neatly carried the simultaneous implications that whatever she had in mind was likely reckless to an alarming degree, and that her propensity for such recklessness had likely come from her red-headed sire. Bree picked that one up too, raised her ruddy brows, and lifted her cup to him in toast.
Well, she said, having taken and savoured her own first sip, you need to get guns and horses.
I do, Jamie said patiently. The horses will be no great matter, though, so long as we do it carefully. I can get them from the Cherokee.
She nodded and flipped a hand in acceptance of that. All right. The guns. You actually have 2 problems there, don't you?
I'd be happy if it were only 2, he said, taking another sip. Which problems do you mean, lass?
Buying the guns. Oh, I see what you mean about more than 2 problems. But putting that aside for a minute, you need to buy the guns and then you need to get them back here. Do you have an idea where you're going to get them, by the way?
Fergus,
Jamie said promptly.
How?
I asked, staring at him.
He's in Charlestown, he said. The Americans hold the city under General Lincoln. And where there's an army, there are guns.
You're planning to steal guns from the Continental Army? I blurted. Or make Fergus do it, which is even worse?
No, he said patiently. That would be treason, eh? I'm going to buy them from whoever is stealing them. Someone always is. Fergus will likely ken who the local smugglers are already, but if not, I've considerable faith that he can find out.
It'll cost a pretty price, Roger said, lifting a brow.
Jamie grimaced, nodding.
Aye, I've kept that gold safe all these years for the time it should be needed for the cause of revolution. And now it is.
Okay, Bree said patiently. Let's say that Fergus can get hold of guns for you, one way or another, if he has to pay for them.
Here Jamie smiled, despite the seriousness of the conversation.
Then you need to get the gold to him, and someone then needs to bring the guns back. So?
She took a deep breath and glanced at Roger, then stuck up a thumb.
One. Now the harvest is in, we need to get Germain home to his family in Charlestown as soon as we can. He's dying to see his mother and his new baby brothers.
Two. The index finger rose.
Lord John wants me to come paint a portrait in Savannah, for which I'll get paid in actual money, which we need for things like clothes and tools. And three. She raised the middle finger, and without looking at Roger, said, Roger needs to be ordained. The sooner the better.
Jamie turned his head to look at Roger, who had flushed deeply at this.
Well, you do, Bree said to him.
Without waiting for an answer, she turned back to Jamie and laid both hands flat on the table.
So, I write back to Lord John right away and tell him I'll do it, and I don't need guards, thank you. But Roger is traveling with me, and we're bringing the kids. Because if we don't make it back before snowfall, she explained, turning her face to me, it could be 5 or 6 months before we see them again. And, she added, looking squarely at Jamie, I think they'll be safer going with us than staying here. What if Captain Cunningham's friends decide to come back and bring a militia through the ridge and loot and burn this house while they're at it? The blunt question gave me a shock, and clearly unsettled both Jamie and Roger, too. Jamie cleared his throat carefully.
You think I'd be taken unawares? He asked mildly.
No, I think you'd clean their clocks, she said, half smiling. But that doesn't mean I want the kids in the middle of that kind of fight, especially without me and Roger here to keep them out of the line of fire.
Her hands were still flat on the table, and so were Jamie's, and I saw the echo in their flesh, his hands large and battered, the knuckles enlarged by work and by age, one finger missing, and the others scarred but still holding a long-fingered, powerful grace. The same grace, unmarred and smooth-skinned, but likewise powerful in Brianna's.
So, she said, taking a breath, I tell Lord John I'll do it, but that we'll come through Charleston first, so that Roger can check into whatever else he needs to do for ordination, and to get Germain back to his family.
Lord John likes Germain, she continued, smiling despite the seriousness of the situation.
He'll want to help. So I ask him to send me a passport, or whatever you call it these days, signed by his brother, an official letter that gives us free passage without interference through roads and cities held by the British Army. We'll be an innocent minister's family with three kids, and travelling under the protection of the Duke of Padlow, who's the colonel of whatever his regiment is. What are the odds of anybody strip-searching us?
Jamie's brows drew together, and I could see that he was reckoning those odds, and while still not liking them, was obliged to admit that it was a plan.
I will, he said reluctantly. That might work, for getting the gold to Fergus. And I can maybe arrange something for the whisky. There's always sauerkraut. But I'm no having you come back with a load of contraband muskets in your wagon. Ordained minister or no, he added, raising an eyebrow at Roger. I've called on God for a good deal of help in my life and got it. But I'm no asking him to save me or you from my own foolishness.
I'm with you on that one, Roger assured him. How long would it take, do you think, to get a reply from his lordship with the clearance papers?
Maybe 2 or 3 weeks, if the weather holds.
Then we'll have time to think what to do with the guns, always assuming we get them.
Roger lifted his hitherto untasted cup and clinked it against mine.
Here's to crime and insurrection.
Did you say sauerkraut? Brianna asked.
Chapter 43
The men you gang oot with.
Over the next few weeks, the different approaches to God on offer at the meeting house collected their own adherents. Many people attended more than one service, whether from an eclectic approach to ritual, indecision, a desire for society, if not instruction, or simply because it was more interesting to go to church than it was to sit at home piously reading the Bible out loud to their families. Still, each service had its own core of worshippers who came every Sunday, plus a varying number of floaters and droppers in. When the weather was fine, many people remained for the day, picnicking under the trees, comparing notes on the Methodist service versus the Presbyterian one. And, being largely Highland Scots, possessed of strong personal opinions, arguing about everything from the message of the sermon to the state of the minister's shoes. Rachel's meeting attracted fewer people, and many fewer arguments, but those who came to sit in silence and in company to listen to their inner light came every week, and little by little, more came. It wasn't always completely silent, as Ian noted. The spirit had its own opinions, and some meetings were very lively. But I thought that for a number of the women, at least, the opportunity to just sit down for an hour in a quiet place was worth more than even the most inspired preaching or singing. Jamie and I always attended all three services, both because the landlord couldn't be seen to show partiality, even if the Presbyterian minister was his own son-in-law, and the Quaker presider, instigator? I wasn't sure what one might call Rachel, other than perhaps a speck of sand inside a pearl, his niece by marriage. And because it allowed him to keep his thumb firmly on the pulse of the ridge. After each of the morning services, I would take up my station under a particular huge chestnut tree and run a casual clinic for an hour or so, dressing minor injuries, looking down throats, and offering advice, along with a surreptitious, because it was Sunday after all, bottle of tonic, this being a concoction of raw but well-watered whiskey and sugar with assorted herbal substances added for the treatment of vitamin deficiency, alleviation of toothache or indigestion, or, in cases where I suspected its need, a slug of turpentine to kill hookworms. Meanwhile, Jamie, often with Ian at his elbow, would wander from one group of men to another, greeting everyone, chatting and listening. Always listening.
"You cannot keep politics secret, Sassenach," he told me, "even if they wanted to. And they mostly don't want to. They cannot hold their tongues or disguise what they think."
"What they think in terms of political principle? Or what they think of their neighbours' political principles?" I asked, having caught the echoes of these discussions from women who formed the major part of my pastoral Sunday surgery. He laughed, but not with a lot of humour in it.
"If they tell you what their neighbour thinks, Sassenach, it doesn't take much mind-reading to ken what they think."
"Do you think they know what you're thinking?" I asked, curious. He shrugged.
"If they don't, they soon will."
2 weeks later, when Captain Cunningham had finished the final prayer, but before he could dismiss his congregation, Jamie rose to his feet and asked the captain's permission to address the people. I saw Elspeth Cunningham's back, always straight as a pine sapling, go rigid, the black feathers on her church-going hat quivering in warning. Still, the captain didn't have much choice, and with a fair assumption of graciousness, he stepped back and gestured Jamie to take the floor.
"Good morning to you all," he said, with a bow to the congregation. "And I ask your pardon, and Captain Cunningham's," another bow, "for needing to disturb your peace of mind on a Sunday. But I've had a wee note this week that's disturbed my own peace of mind considerably, and I hope you'll give me the opportunity to share it with you."
A murmur of agreement, puzzlement, and interest passed through the room, along with a subterranean rumble, barely felt, of apprehension. Jamie reached into his coat
and removed a folded note with a broken candle-wax seal that had seeped grease into the paper, so that the shadows of words showed through as he unfolded it. He put on his spectacles and read it aloud.
"Mr. Fraser, I take the liberty of telling you I have had word that General Gates attacked the forces of Lord Cornwallis near Camden and suffered a great defeat, including the lamentable death of Major General de Kalb. With the retreat of Gates's forces, South Carolina is abandoned to the enemy. Meanwhile, I hear that additional troops are being sent north from Florida to support the occupation of Savannah. Such news is alarming, but I am alarmed further to hear from some friends that General Clinton plans to attack the backcountry by other, more insidious means. He proposes to send agents among us to solicit, enlist, and arm loyalists, and by so doing, to raise a large militia, supported by the regular army, to attack and subdue any hint of rebellion in the mountains of Tennessee and the Carolinas. It is my firm belief that this is no idle rumor, and I will send you various proofs as they come into my hands. Therefore,
as he read, I had the oddest feeling of déjà vu, a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach and the ripple of goose flesh up my arms. The room was hot and moist as a Turkish bath, but I felt as though I stood in a cold, empty room with an icy Scottish rain beating at the window, hearing words of inescapable doom. And herewith acknowledge the support of these divine rites by the chieftains of the Highland clans, the Jacobite lords and various others such loyal subjects of His Majesty King James as have subscribed their names upon this bill of association in token thereof. No. Oh, God, no! I hadn't meant to say it aloud, but it escaped my lips, though only in a whisper that made the people to each side of me glance sideways, then hastily away, as though I had suddenly sprouted leprosy. Jamie finished.
I urge you, therefore, to make such preparations as lie in your power, and stand ready to join us in case of urgent need to defend our lives and liberty.
There was a moment of ringing silence, and then Jamie folded the note and spoke before the reaction of the crowd could erupt.
I shall not tell you the name of the gentleman who sent me this letter, for he is a gentleman known to me by name and reputation, and I will not endanger him. I believe that what he says is true.
People were staring all round me, but I sat frozen staring at him. No, not again. Please, not again.
But you knew, the reasonable part of my mind was saying. You knew it was coming back. You knew he couldn't get out of the way. And he wouldn't, even if he could. I ken very well that some here profess loyalty to the king. You all ken that I do not. You'll do as your conscience bids you, and so will I.
He met the eyes of men here and there in the audience, but avoided looking at Captain Cunningham, who stood, quite expressionless, to one side.
I will not drive any man from his land for what he believes.
Jamie stopped for a moment, took his glasses off, and looked directly from face to face to face, before continuing. I knew he was looking at the men he knew to be professed loyalists, and repressed the urge to look round.
But this land, and its tenants, are mine to protect, and I will do that.
I'll need help in this endeavour, and to that end I will be raising a militia. Should you choose to join me, I will arm you, feed you on the march, and provide mounts for those men who may not have one. I could feel Samuel Chisholm, aged 18 or so, sitting next to me, stiffen and move his feet slightly under him, plainly deciding whether to leap to his feet and volunteer on the spot. Jamie saw him move and lifted his hand slightly with a brief smile.
Those who wish to join me today, come and speak with me outside. Those who wish to think on the matter may come to my house at any time. Day or night, he added, with a wry twist of the mouth that made a few people titter nervously. Your servant, sir,
he said, turning to a stone-faced Captain Cunningham,
"and I thank you for your courtesy."
He walked steadily down the aisle between the benches, put down a hand to me and pulled me up, gave me his arm, and we walked briskly out, leaving a dropped-pin silence behind us. He did the same thing at the Presbyterian service, Roger standing gravely behind him, eyes cast down. Here, though, the audience was prepared. Everyone had heard what had happened at the Methodist service. No sooner had he finished speaking than Bill Amos was on his feet.
"We'll ride with you, McDo," he said firmly, "me and my lads."
Bill Amos was a handsome, black-haired, solid man, both physically and in terms of character, and there were murmurs of agreement among the people. Three or four more men rose on the spot to pledge themselves, and I could feel the hum of excitement stirring the humid air. I could feel the sense of cold dread among the women, too. Several of them had spoken to me during my surgery between the services.
"Can you no persuade your man otherwise?" Mari Gordon had asked me, low-voiced, and looking round to be sure she wasn't overheard. "I've only my great-grandson, and I'll be left alone to starve if he's killed."
Mari was near my own age and had lived through the days after Culloden. I could see the fear at the back of her eyes and felt it too. I'll talk to him," I said awkwardly. I could, and I would, try to persuade Jamie not to take Hugh Gordon, but I knew quite well what his answer would be.
"We won't let you starve," I said, with as much confidence as I could muster, "no matter what."
"Aye,
well,"
she'd muttered, and let me dress the burn on her arm in silence. The sense of excitement followed us out of the church. Men were clustering around Jamie. Other men were in their own clusters under the trees in the shadow of the pines. I looked, but didn't see Captain Cunningham among them. Perhaps he knew better than to declare himself openly.
Yet
the coldness I had felt in church was a shifting weight in my belly, like a pool of mercury. I went on talking pleasantly with the women and children, and the occasional man with a crushed toe or a splinter in his eye, but I could feel what was happening all too clearly. Jamie had split the ridge, and the fracture lines were spreading. He'd done it on purpose and from necessity, but that didn't make the fact of it easier to bear. In the space of 3 hours, we had gone from a community, however contentious, to openly opposing camps. The earthquake had struck, and the aftershocks would continue. Neighbours would be no longer neighbours, but stated enemies. War had been declared. Usually, people would mill slowly after church, groups forming and splitting and reforming as friends were greeted, news exchanged, cloth spread, food unpacked, conversation rising under the trees like the comforting buzz of a working hive. Not today. Families drew in upon themselves. Friends who found themselves still on the same side sought each other out for reassurance, but the ridge had split, and its shattered pieces drifted slowly away along the forest paths, leaving the hot, thick air to settle on the vacant church, empty of peace. My last patient, old ma'am, who had, she said, a room in her back, was led away by one of her daughters, clutching a bottle of extra-strong tonic, and I heaved a deep, unrefreshing breath and started putting away my instruments and supplies. Bree had taken the children home. Plainly there was to be no picnic lunch under the trees on this Sunday, but Roger was still standing outside the church with Jamie and Ian, the three of them talking quietly. The sight gave me some comfort. At least Jamie wasn't alone in this. Ian nodded to Roger and Jamie and went off toward his own house, waving briefly to me in farewell. Jamie came down to me, still talking to Roger.
"I'm sorry, Minister,"
he was saying, as they came within earshot.
"I wouldn't have done it in Kirk, but I had to reach the Loyalists at the same time as the Rebels, Ken. And most of them didn't come to lodge anymore."
"Nae bother, man,"
Roger patted him briefly on the back and smiled. It was a slightly forced smile, but genuine for all that.
I understand.
He nodded to me, then turned back to Jamie.
Do you plan to go to Rachel's meeting too?
He was careful to keep any sort of edge out of his voice, but Jamie heard it anyway.
Aye,
he said, straightening himself with a sigh. Then, seeing Roger's face, he made a small, wry grimace.
Not to recruit a Valach.
To sit in the silence and ask forgiveness. Chapter 44. Beetles with Tiny Red Eyes. Savannah, late August. William had, out of what even he would admit to himself in the depths of his heart was simple obstinacy, though he passed it off to his conscience as honesty and pride, of a shockingly republican nature but still pride, taken up residence in a small shed-like house on the edge of the marshes with John Cinnamon. Lord John had, without comment, given him a room at No. 12 Oglethorpe Street, though, and he often slept there when he had come for supper. He had also continued wearing the clothes in which he had arrived in Savannah, though Lord John's manservant took them away every night and brushed, laundered, or mended them before returning them in the morning. On this particular morning, though, William woke to the sight of a suit of dark grey velvet, with a waistcoat in ochre silk, tastefully embroidered with small beetles of varying colours, each with tiny red eyes. Fresh linen and silk stockings were laid out alongside, but his ex-army kit had disappeared, save for the disreputable boots, which stood like a reproach beside his washstand, their scuffs and scars blushing through fresh blacking. He paused for a moment, then put on the banyan Papa had lent him. Fine woven blue wool, comforting on a chilly morning, as it had rained in the night, washed his face, and went down to breakfast. Papa and Amaranthus were at the table, both looking as though they'd been dug up rather than roused from bed. "Good morning," William said rather loudly, and sat down. "Where's Trevor?" "Somewhere with your friend, Mr. Cinnamon," Amaranthus said, blinking sleepily. "God bless him. He came by looking for you, and as you were still sunk in hoggish slumber, he said he would take Trevor for a walk."
"The little fiend yowled all night long," Lord John said, shoving a pot of mustard in William's direction.
"Kipper's coming," he added, evidently in explanation of the mustard. "Didn't you hear him?" "Unlike some people, I slept the sleep of the just," William said, buttering a piece of toast.
"Didn't hear a sound."
Both relatives eyed him beadily over the toast rack. "I'm putting him in your bed tonight," Amaranthus said, attempting to smooth her frowsy locks. "See how justified you feel around dawn." A smell of smoky sweet bacon wafted from the back of the house, and all three diners sat up involuntarily as the cook brought in a generous silver platter bearing not only bacon, but also sausages, black pudding, and grilled mushrooms.
"Il ne fera pas cuire les tomates," his lordship said with a slight shrug. "She won't cook tomatoes any more."
"Elle pense qu'elles sont toxiques."
"She thinks they're poisonous."
"La façon dont elle les cuit, elle a raison," Amaranthus muttered in good but oddly accented French.
"The way she cooks them, she's right."
William saw his father raise a brow. Evidently he hadn't realized that she spoke French at all.
I saw the garments you kindly had prepared for me," William said tactfully, diverting the conversation. "I'm most appreciative, of course, though I don't think I shall have occasion to wear them at present. Perhaps grey will suit you very well," Lord John said, looking happier when Moira came in and set down a glass of what smelled like coffee with whiskey in it next to him. He nodded toward Amaranthus, seated across from William. "Your cousin embroidered the beetles on the waistcoat herself."
"Oh, thank you, cousin." He bowed to her, smiling. "By far the most fanciful waistcoat I've ever owned." She straightened up, looking indignant, and pulled her wrapper tight across her bosom. "They aren't fanciful at all. Every single one of those beetles is to be found in this colony,
and all of them are the right colours and shapes. Well, she added, her indignation subsiding, I'll admit that the red eyes really were a touch of fancy on my part. I just thought the pattern required more red than a single ladybird beetle would provide.
Entirely appropriate, Lord John assured her. Haven't you ever heard of Licentia Poetica, Willie?
William,
William said coolly.
And yes, I have. Thank you, cuz, for my charmingly poetical beetles. Have they names?
Certainly, Amaranthus said. She was perking up under the influence of tea and sausages. There was a tinge of pink in her cheeks.
I'll tell you them later when you're wearing it.
A slight but unmistakable frisson went through William at that, when you're wearing it, together with an instantaneous vision of her slender finger slowly moving from beetle to beetle over his chest. He wasn't imagining it. Papa had glanced sharply at Amaranthus when she said it. There was no sign of intentional flirtation on her face, though. Her eyes were fixed on the steaming dish of kippers as it was set down before her. William took a dollop of mustard and pushed the pot over to her.
Beetles and vinery notwithstanding, he said, I can't be wearing grey velvet breeches to clear out a shed with cinnamon, which is my chief errand today.
Actually not, William, said Lord John, lending his name the lightest touch of irony. Your presence is required at luncheon with General Prévost.
William's kipper-loaded fork stopped halfway to his mouth.
Why? He asked warily. What the devil has General Prévost got to do with me?
Nothing, I hope,
his father said, reaching for the mustard. He's a decent soldier. But what with a heavy Swiss accent and no sense of humour, having a conversation with him is like pushing a hogshead of tobacco uphill. However, Lord John added, peering over the table, do you see the pepper pot anywhere?
However, he's entertaining a party of politicals from London at present, and a couple of Cornwallis's senior officers have come down from South Carolina to meet them.
And?
Aha! Got you.
Lord John said, lifting a napkin and discovering the pepper pot under it.
And I hear that one Dennis Randall, alias Dennis Randall Isaacs, is to be one of the party. He sent me a note this morning saying that he understood you were staying with me, and would I be so kind as to bring you with me and Hal to lunch, he having procured an invitation for you.
It was hot and muggy, but clouds were gathering overhead, casting a welcome shade.
I doubt it will rain before tea time, Lord John said, glancing up as they left the house. Do you want a cloak for the sake of your new waistcoat, though?
No.
William's mind was not on his clothes, fine as they were, nor was it really on Dennis Randall. Whatever Randall had to say, he'd hear it soon enough. His mind was on Jane. He'd avoided walking down Barnard Street since he and Cinnamon had reached Savannah. The garrison headquarters was in a house on Barnard, no more than half a mile from No. 12 Oglethorpe Street. Across the square from headquarters was the commander's house, a large, fine house with an oval pane of glass set in the front door. And growing in the centre of the square was a huge live oak, bearded with moss. The gallows tree. His father was saying something, but William wasn't attending. He dimly felt Lord John notice and stopped talking. They walked in silence to Uncle Hal's house, where they found him waiting in full dress uniform. He eyed William's suit and nodded in approval, but didn't say anything beyond,
If Prévost offers you a commission, don't take it.
Why would I?
William replied shortly, to which his uncle grunted in a way that probably indicated agreement. His father and uncle walked together behind him, giving his longer stride room. They hadn't managed to hang Jane, but they locked her in a room in the house with the oval window, overlooking the tree, and left her alone to wait out her last night on earth. She'd died by candlelight, cutting her wrists with a broken bottle, choosing her own fate. He could smell the beer and the blood,
saw her face in the guttering light of that candle, calm, remote, showing no fear. She'd have been pleased to know that. She hated people to know she was afraid.
Why couldn't I have saved you?
Didn't you know I'd come for you? They passed under the branches of the tree, boots shuffling through the layers of damp leaves knocked down by the rain.
Sturgis, Uncle Hal said behind him, and he turned, startled.
What? What indeed?
Uncle Hal nodded at the small group of men coming from the other side of the square. Some of them were dressed as gentlemen, perhaps the London politicals, but with them were several officers, including Colonel Archibald Campbell.
For an instant, William wished John Cinnamon was at his back, rather than his father and uncle. On the other hand, he heard his father snort and Uncle Hal make a grim sort of humming noise in his throat. Smiling a little, William strode purposefully up to Campbell, who had paused to say something to one of the gentlemen.
"Good day to you, sir," he said to Campbell, and moved purposefully toward the door, just close enough to Campbell to make him step back automatically. Behind him, he heard Uncle Hal say, with exquisite politeness, "Your servant, sir," followed by his father's cordial, "Such a pleasure to see you again, Colonel. I hope we find you well." If there was a reply to this pleasantry, William didn't hear it, but given the expression on Campbell's face, crimson-cheeked and small blueberry eyes shooting daggers at the grey party, he gathered there had been one. Feeling much better, William waited for Uncle Hal to come up and manage the introductions to General Prevost and his staff, which he did with a curt but adequate courtesy. He gathered that there was no love lost between Prevost and his uncle, but that they acknowledged each other as professional soldiers and would do whatever was necessary to address a military situation without regard to personalities. He shook hands with Prevost, looking covertly to see if the scar was visible. Papa had said Prevost was called Old Bullet Head as a result of having his skull fractured by a bullet that struck him in the head at the Battle of Quebec. To his gratification, he could see it, a noticeable depression of the bone just above the temple, showing as a hollow shadow under the edge of Prevost's wig.
"My lord," said a voice at his elbow as he went into the reception room where the guests were assembling to be given sherry and savoury biscuits to prevent starvation before the luncheon should be served.
"Mr. Ransom," William said firmly, turning to see Dennis Randall, uniformed and looking much more soigné in his toilet than on previous meeting.
"Your servant, sir."
He looked back and saw that Campbell's party had come in, but that Uncle Hal and his father had, in the meantime, somehow contrived to flank Prevost, behaving as though they were part of the official receiving line, greeting each of the London politicals, several of whom Uncle Hal appeared to know, with effusive welcome before Campbell could introduce them. Smiling, he turned back to Dennis.
"Any word of my cousin?"
"Not directly."
Randall snagged two glasses of sherry from a passing tray and handed one to William.
"But I do know the name of the British officer who received the original letter with the news of your cousin's death."
"Colonel Richardson?" William asked, disappointed.
"Yes, I know that."
But Dennis was shaking his head.
"No. The letter was sent to Richardson by Colonel Bannister Tarleton."
William's sherry went down sideways and he choked slightly.
"What? Tarleton received the letter from the Americans? How? Why?"
William's last meeting with Ban Tarleton had ended with a pitched fight on the battleground at Monmouth over Jane. William was reasonably sure he'd won.
"I would really like to know that,"
Dennis replied, bowing to a gentleman in blue velvet across the room.
"And I sincerely hope you'll find out and tell me. Meanwhile, have you heard anything of our friend Ezekiel Richardson?"
"Yes, but probably nothing very helpful. My father received a letter from a sailing captain of his acquaintance, who mentioned casually that he'd seen Richardson on the docks in Charlestown."
"When?"
Dennis betrayed no open excitement at the news, but cocked his head like a terrier, wondering whether he had just heard the scrabbling of a gopher underground.
The letter was dated a month ago. No telling whether the captain saw the fellow then or sometime before. No hint that Schmemmerhorn, that's the captain, knows that Ezekiel Richardson is a turncoat, by the way, so I suppose he wasn't in uniform. Not an American uniform, I mean.
Nothing else? The terrier was disappointed, but perked up again at William's next bit of information.
Apparently, Richardson was with a gentleman named Hame, but he didn't say anything about what they were doing or whom Hame might be.
I know who he is.
Dennis kept control of his expression, but his interest was plain. The conversation was interrupted at this point by the banging of a small gong and the butler's announcement that luncheon was served, and he found himself separated as another acquaintance hailed Dennis.
All right, Willie.
His father popped up beside him as he made his way through the double doors of the reception room into a generous hall with a fantastic floor cloth of painted canvas, done in simulation of the mosaic of a Roman villa.
Has he found out anything about Ben?
Not much, but there may be something.
He hastily conveyed the gist of his conversation with Randall.
He says he knows the man Richardson was seen with in Charlestown. Hame.
Hame?
Uncle Hal had caught up with him in time to hear this and lifted an eyebrow at the name.
Possibly, said William. You know him?
Not to say no, his uncle said with a shrug, but I have heard of a rich Polish Jew named Hame Salomon. I can't think what the devil he'd be doing in Charlestown, though. The last I heard of him, he'd been sentenced to death as a spy in New York.
Luncheon was tedious, with small patches of aggravation. William found himself seated between a Mr. Sykes Hallett, who seemed to be a member of Parliament from some place in Yorkshire, judging from his incomprehensible accent, and a slender, stylish gentleman in a bottle-green coat called Fungo, or possibly Fungus, who burbled about the brilliance of the Southern campaign, about which he plainly knew nothing. Nor did he notice the stony looks of the soldiers seated near him, and kept addressing William as Lord Ellesmere, though he'd been tersely invited to stop. William thought he caught a sympathetic look from Uncle Hal at the adjoining table, but wasn't sure.
"Do I understand correctly that you have resigned your commission, Lord Ellesmere?"
the green fungus asked between nibbles of poached salmon.
"Colonel Campbell said that you had. Some trouble about a girl? Mind, I don't blame you a bit."
He raised a hair-thin eyebrow in a knowing fashion.
"A military career is well enough for men who have capacity, but no means. But I understand that you, fortunately, do not require to make your way in life at the cost, at least the potential cost, of your blood."
William had been raised to exercise courtesy, even in adverse circumstances, and thus merely took a forkful of the rabbit tureen and put it into his mouth instead of stabbing Fungo in the throat with it.
Now, had it been Campbell?
But it wasn't really Campbell's malice that troubled him. He hadn't realised how much it would bother him not being a soldier any more. He felt like an impostor, an interloper, a useless and despised lump, sitting here among soldiers in a waistcoat covered with fucking beetles, for God's sake. It was a large gathering, some 30 men, two-thirds of them in uniform, and he could feel the lines drawn between the civilians and the soldiers clearly. Respect, certainly, but respect with an underlying scorn on both sides.
"What a charming waistcoat, sir," said the man across the table, smiling. "I admit to a great partiality for beetles. I had an uncle who collected them. He left his collection to the British Museum when he died."
The man's name was Preston, William thought, second secretary to the Under Secretary of War or something. Still, he wasn't either sneering or leering. He had a strong, though rather homely face, with a large, crooked nose that bore a pair of pince-nez, and obviously intended nothing more than friendly conversation.
"My cousin embroidered them for me, sir,"
William said with a slight bow. Her father is a naturalist, and she assures me that they are completely correct, save for the eyes, which were her particular fancy.
Your cousin?
Preston glanced at the next table where Papa and Uncle Hal were engaged in conversation with Prévost and his two principal guests, a minor nobleman sent as a representative of Lord George Germain, the Secretary of State for the Colonies, and a dressy Frenchman of some sort.
Surely it's not the Duke who is a naturalist.
Oh, but of course, the uncle must be on your mother's side.
No, sir. I have misled you. She is my cousin's widow, my uncle's daughter-in-law.
He tilted his head in the direction of Uncle Hal.
Her husband died as a prisoner of war in New Jersey, and she and her young son have taken refuge with us.
My profound sympathies to the young woman, my lord, Preston said, looking genuinely concerned. I suppose her husband was an officer. Do you know his regiment?
Yes, William said, letting the my lord pass.
The 34th.
Why?
I am a very junior undersecretary of the War Office, my lord,
charged with overseeing the support of our prisoners of war. Pitifully meagre support, I'm afraid, he added with a tightening of the mouth.
In most cases, all I can do is to solicit and organise help from churches and compassionate loyalists in the vicinity of the prisons. The Americans are so straitened in their means that they can scarce afford to feed their own troops, let alone their prisoners. And I blush to say that the same is often very nearly true of the British Army as well.
Preston sat back as two footmen arrived with the soup.
This is not the time or the place for such discussions, Preston said, peering round a bowl descending in front of him. But if you should be at leisure later, my lord, I should be most grateful if you would tell me what you can about your cousin and the conditions in which he was held, if it is not too painful, he added hastily, with another glance at Uncle Hal.
I should be happy to, William said, taking up his silver soup spoon and essaying the lobster bisque.
Perhaps we might meet at the Arches this evening. The Pink House, you know. I shouldn't want to cause my uncle distress.
He glanced at Uncle Hal, too. His uncle appeared to be experiencing indigestion, whether of a physical or spiritual nature, and Papa was regarding his soup with a very fixed expression.
Of course.
Mr. Preston glanced quickly at the Duke and lowered his voice.
I hesitate to ask, but do you think that your father might perhaps accompany you later? His experience with prisoners was, of course, some time ago, but...
Prisoners? William felt something small and hard bob in his midsection, as though he'd inadvertently swallowed a golf ball.
My father?
Mr. Preston blinked, taken aback.
Forgive me, my lord, I had thought...
That doesn't matter.
William waved a hand. What did you mean, though?
His experience with prisoners.
Why, Lord John was the governor of a prison in Scotland, perhaps 25, perhaps, years ago.
Now, what was the name?
Oh, of course, Ardsmuir.
You did not know that.
Dear me, I do beg your pardon.
25 years ago,
William repeated.
I suppose some of the prisoners might have been Jacobite traitors
from the Rising.
Oh, indeed.
Mr. Preston said, looking happier now that it seemed William was not offended.
Most of them, as I recall. I have written one or two small books on the subject of prison reform, and the handling of the Jacobite prisoners comprised a significant portion of my researches. I could tell you a bit more about it, perhaps, this evening. Shall we say at 10 o'clock?
Charmed, William said cordially, and put the spoonful of cold soup into his mouth. Chapter 45. Not quite like leprosy. Lord John lifted a spoonful of hot soup and held it suspended to cool,
not removing his gaze from the gentleman sitting across the table from him, next to Prévost. He could feel Hal vibrating next to him, and wondered briefly whether to spill the soup on Hal's leg as means of getting him out of the dining room before he said or did something injudicious. Their erstwhile stepbrother, who had just been introduced to them as the Cavalier Saint-Honoré, couldn't help but be aware of their reaction to his presence, but he preserved a perfect sang-froid, letting his gaze pass vacantly over the brother's grey, meeting neither one's eyes. He was chatting to Prévost in Parisian French, and so far as Grey could tell, was actually pretending to be a Frenchman, damn his eyes.
Percy, you...
Rather to his surprise, he was unable to apply a suitable epithet. He neither liked nor trusted Percy, but once he had loved the man, and he was sufficiently honest with himself as to admit it. Percival Wainwright. His real name was Perseverance, but John was willing to wager that he was the only person on earth who knew that, was looking well, and well turned out, in an expensive and fashionable suit of puce silk with a striped waistcoat in pale blue and white. He still had delicate, attractive features with soft brown eyes, but whatever he had been doing of recent years had given him a new firmness of expression and new lines bracketing his mouth.
Monsieur?
John said to Percy directly, and bowing to him, continued in French, "Allow me to introduce myself. I am Lord John Grey, and this," he nodded toward Hal, who was breathing rather noisily, "is my brother, the Duke of Pardlow. We are honoured by your company, but find ourselves curious as to what stroke of fortune should have brought you here."
"À votre service,"
Percy replied with an equally civil bow. Did John imagine the spark in his eye? No, he did not, he concluded, and he casually let his hand fall on his brother's knee, squeezing in a manner intended to suggest that one word out of Hal and he'd be limping for hours. Hal cleared his throat in a menacing tone, but likewise bowed, not taking his eyes off Percy as he did so.
"I am here at the invitation of Mr. Robert Boyer,"
Percy said, switching to English with a slight French accent. He tilted his head slightly, indicating a portly gentleman at a neighbouring table, whose wine-coloured suit was the exact shade of the burst blood vessels in his bulbous nose.
"Monsieur Boyer owns several ships and holds contracts with both the Royal Navy and the Army for the supplying of victuals and other necessaries. He has some matters of importance to discuss with the Major General, and thought that I might be of some small help with details."
The spark grew more pronounced, but Percy luckily refrained from anything overt, giving that Hal was staring holes in his striped waistcoat.
"Indeed," John said casually in English. "How interesting."
And with the briefest of dismissive nods to Percy, he let go of Hal's knee and turned to his partner to the right, this being Mrs. Major General Prévost. Madame General was obviously used to being the only female at military dinners, and seemed startled to be spoken to. John engaged her in descriptions of her garden, and which plants were growing well at the moment, and which ones were not. This occupied relatively little of his attention. Unfortunately, he could hear Hal behind him, talking to his other partner, a much-decorated but elderly and torpid colonel of artillery, who was stone-deaf. Hal's half-shouted queries were punctuated by small, jibing remarks under his breath aimed at Percy, who so far had ignored them. Feeling his joints knot with the urgent need to do something, and unable to kick Percy under the table or give Hal a jolt in the ribs with his elbow, John pushed back his chair and rose abruptly. He headed for the discreet screen in the corner of the dining room that hid the pisspot from view, but the warm tidal reek of the urine of numerous lobster-eaters hit him in the face, and he veered away, going out through the open French doors into the fresh air of the garden. It had been raining, but the downpour had stopped, and water dripped from every tree and shrub. He felt as though there had been an iron band around his chest that broke as he left the house, and he breathed deep, refreshing gulps of cool, rain-washed air. His face felt hot,
and he swiped a hand through the wet leaves of a hydrangea bush and wiped cold water over his face.
"John," said a voice behind him. He stiffened, but didn't turn around.
"Go away," he said. "I don't want to talk to you."
There was a faint snort in reply.
"I dare say," said Percy in his normal English accent, "and I can't say I blame you. But I'm afraid you'll have to, you know."
"No, I won't." John turned, meaning to push past Percy and go back inside, but Percy seized his arm.
"Not so fast," he said. "Buttercup."
John's spinal column reacted much faster than his conscious mind. Both stomach and balls contracted with a force that made him gasp, before his mind managed to inform him that the bloody man really had just used his nom de guerre, the very secret code name under which he had laboured for 3 mortal years in London's Black Chamber. He became aware that he was staring at Percy with his mouth open and closed it. Percy smiled, a little tremulously. The facade of the arrogant, elegant Frenchman had dropped away, and it truly was Percy. His dark curls were hidden under the smooth, powdered wig, but the eyes were as they'd always been, dark, soft, and holding promise of various kinds.
"Don't tell me," John said, surprised that his own voice sounded normal.
"Monsieur Citron?"
"Yes."
Percy's voice was husky, though John couldn't have said with what emotion. Humour, fear, excitement, lust.
The last thought made him shake off Percy's grasp and take a step back.
"How bloody long did you know?" he demanded.
Monsieur Citron had been his opposite number, in France's equivalent to the Black Chamber. All countries had one, though the names varied. The underground hive where worker bees gathered the pollen of intelligence grain by grain and painstakingly turned it into honey. Or poison.
Percy shrugged.
"I'd been working for the Secret du Roi for about 2 years before they gave you to me. It took me another 6 months to discover who you really were."
Not for the first time, John wished he had Jamie Fraser's ability to make glottal noises that made clear his state of mind without the nuisance of finding words. But he was an Englishman, and therefore found some.
"Are you working for Hirondelle now?" he demanded.
The Secret du Roi, Louis XV's private spy ring, had not quite perished with the death of the king, but in the manner of such things had quietly been absorbed into a more officially recognised body. He had himself escaped the clutches of Hubert Bowles, head of London's Black Chamber, some years ago, and had left the world of official secrets behind with the relieved sense of one being fished out of a noisome bog on the end of a rope. Percy raised one shoulder briefly, smiling.
"If I were still true to La Belle France and her masters, you couldn't tell whether I was telling you the truth about that or not, could you?"
John's heart was beginning to slow down, but that "if" sped it up like a kicked horse. He didn't reply at once, though. He took time to look Percy up and down deliberately.
"It's not quite like leprosy, you know," Percy said, bearing this scrutiny with visible amusement. "Treason doesn't show that easily." "The devil it doesn't," John said, but more for something to say than because it was true. "Are you actually telling me that you have, or are about to," he added, with a hard look to Percy's very expensive Parisian finery, "part company with your special interests in France?" "Including whoever you were working for in the Black Chamber, I wonder." "Yes, I haven't done it quite yet, because..."
He glanced involuntarily over his shoulder, and John gave a short laugh.
"Wise of you," he said. "So you're wanting to prepare a soft landing on this side before you jump? And you thought you'd start with me?"
There was enough spin on that question as to take the skin off Percy's hand if he tried to catch it. He didn't catch it, and he didn't duck either,
just stood and let it pass, regarding Gray with his soft, dark eyes.
"You saved my life, John," he said quietly, looking at him. "Thank you for that. I hadn't the chance to say so at the time."
John flipped a hand dismissively, though his chest had tightened at Percy's words. He'd suppressed everything at the time, and he didn't want it back now, 20 years later, any of it.
"Yes."
"Well," he turned slightly. Percy was standing between him and the terrace with the French doors.
"So I thought that you might possibly be willing to do me a much less dangerous favour."
"Think again," John advised him briefly, and stepping around his erstwhile lover, walked rapidly away. He heard nothing behind him, no protest, no offers, no calling of his name. At the open French doors, he glanced involuntarily behind him. Percy was standing by the hydrangea bush, smiling at him. Chapter 46. By the dawn's early light. The sun was well above the horizon when William came ambling slowly down Oglethorpe Street toward his father's house. He'd had a long, fascinating, and very enlightening conversation with Christopher Preston about the Crown's treatment of prisoners, prison help societies, prison hulks, and Ardsmuir Prison. In the fullness of time, he might need to have a talk with Lord John, but not just this minute. He wasn't drunk, but wasn't yet quite sober either. One of his pockets sagged heavily and jingled when he touched it. He had a vague memory of playing cards with Preston and some friends of his. At least this experience seemed to have ended up better than the last time he'd got blind drunk, ended up penniless, and met Jane again. Jane. He hadn't meant to call her to mind, but there she was, vivid, drawn on the surface of his mind with a sharp-pointed quill. The first time he'd met her, and the second. The shine of her hair, and the smell of her body close in the dark. He stopped and leaned heavily on the iron fence surrounding a neighbour's front garden. The scent of flowers and new-turned soils fresh as the morning air on his face, the breath of the distant river and its marshes soothing with its sense of flowing water, soft black silt, and lurking alligators. The unexpected thought of alligators made him laugh, and he rubbed a hand over his rasping whiskers, shook his head, and turned into Papa's gate. He sniffed the air expectantly, but he was early. He could smell smoke from the kitchen fire, but no bacon. Voices, though. He wandered round the side of the house, intending to see whether he might charm Moira, the cook, into giving him a bit of toasted bread or some cheese to ease the pangs of starvation till something more substantial was ready. He found Moira in the kitchen garden, pulling onions. She was talking to Amaranthus, who had evidently been gathering as well. She carried a trug that held a large mound of grapes and a couple of pears from the small tree that grew near the cookhouse. With an eye for the fruit, he strode up and bade the women good morning. Amaranthus gave him an up-and-down glance, inhaled as though trying to judge his state of intoxication from his aroma, and with a faint shake of the head, handed him a pear.
"Coffee," he said hopefully to Moira. "Well, I'll not be saying there isn't," she said dubiously. "It's left from yesterday, though, and strong enough to take the shine off your teeth."
"Perfect," he assured her, and bit into the pear, closing his eyes as the luscious juice flooded his mouth. He opened them to find Amaranthus, back turned to him, stooping to look at something on the ground among the radishes. She was wearing a thin wrapper over her shift, and the fabric stretched neatly over her very round bottom. She stood up suddenly, turning round, and he at once bent toward the ground she'd been looking at, saying, "What is that?" though he personally saw nothing but dirt and a lot of radish tops.
"It's a dung beetle," she said, looking at him closely. "Very good for the soil. They roll up small balls of ordure and trundle them away."
"What do they do with them? The balls of ordure, I mean,"
eat them, she said with a slight shrug. They bury the balls for safekeeping, and then eat them as need requires. Or sometimes they breed inside the larger ones.
How cozy.
Have you had any breakfast? William asked, raising one brow. No, it isn't ready yet.
Neither have I, he said, getting to his feet. Though I'm not quite as hungry as I was before you told me that.
He glanced down at his waistcoat.
Have I any dung beetles in this noble assemblage?
That made her laugh.
No, you haven't, she said. Not nearly colourful enough.
Amaranthus was suddenly standing quite close to him, though he was sure he hadn't seen her move. She had the odd trick of seeming to appear suddenly out of thin air. It was disconcerting, but rather intriguing.
That bright green one, she said, pointing a long, delicate finger at his middle, is a dogbane leaf beetle, Chrysochus auratus.
Is it really?
Yes. And this lovely creature with the long nose is a billbug.
A pillbug?
William squinted down his chest.
No, a billbug, she said, tapping the bug in question. It's a sort of weevil, but it eats cattails and young corn.
Rather a varied diet.
Well, unless you're a dung beetle, you do have some choice in what you eat, she said, smiling.
She touched another of the beetles, and William felt a faint but noticeable jolt at the base of his spine.
Now here, she said, with small distinct taps of her finger, we have ash borer, a festive tiger beetle, and the false potato beetle.
What does a true potato beetle look like?
Very much the same. This one's called a false potato beetle because while it will eat potatoes in a pinch, it really prefers horse nettles.
Ah.
He thought he should express interest in the rest of the little red-eyed things ornamenting his waistcoat, partially to repay her kindness in embroidering them, but more in hopes that she'd go on tapping them. He was opening his mouth to inquire about a large cream-coloured thing with horns when she stepped back in order to look up into his face.
"I heard my father-in-law talking to Lord John about you," she said.
"Oh, good. I hope they'd a fine day for it," he said, not really caring.
"Speaking of false potato beetles, I mean," she said.
He closed his eyes briefly, then opened one and looked at her. She was perfectly solid, not wavering in the slightest.
"I know I'm a trifle the worse for drink," he said politely, "but I don't think I resemble any sort of potato beetle, regardless of my uncle's opinion."
She laughed, showing very white teeth.
Maybe she didn't drink coffee.
"No, you don't," she assured him. "The dichotomy just reminded me of what Father Pardlow was saying, that you wanted to renounce your title but couldn't."
He felt suddenly almost sober.
"Really? Did you happen to overhear the reason?"
"No," she said, "and it's not my business, is it?"
"Evidently you think it is," he said. "Or why are you mentioning it?"
She bent and plucked a small bunch of grapes out of the trug, offering it to him. Moira, he noticed, had gone about her business.
"Well, I thought that if that's truly the case, I might be able to suggest something."
With an odd sense of exhilaration, he took the grapes and asked,
"Such as?"
"Well,"
she said, as reasonably as though she were describing the eating habits of a firefly,
"it's quite simple. You can't renounce your title, but you could hand it on. Abdicate in favour of your heir, I mean."
"I haven't an heir. Are you suggesting—"
"Yes, exactly," she nodded approvingly at him. "You marry me, and as soon as I have a son, you can give him your title, and either retire into private life and breed dachshunds, or perhaps pretend to commit suicide and go off to become anyone you like."
"Leaving you?"
"Leaving me, as the Dowager Countess of whatever your estate is called. I forget. That might be slightly better than being the Duke of Pardlow's penurious daughter-in-law, mightn't it?"
He took a deep breath. Coffee was indeed on the wind, and so was bacon, but he'd suddenly lost interest in food. He stared at her.
She cocked one smooth blonde eyebrow.
"And what if your next child is a daughter?" he said, to his own surprise. "And the one after that? It seems to me that I should be in substantial danger of ending with a harem of girls, all in need of dowries and marriages, and myself still a bloody earl."
Her brow wrinkled slightly. "What's a harem?"
"It's what Arab sheikhs do to leaven the monotony of marriage, or so I'm told. Polygamy, I mean."
"Surely you don't mean to imply that you think being married to me would be boring, William?"
A shadow of a dimple flickered in her cheek. "But as for harems, nonsense.
You needn't marry me straight off, you know. We'd give it a go. And if the result is male, then you marry me, acknowledge the child, and..."
She gave a flick of her hand in a silent voila. "I don't believe I'm having this conversation," he said, shaking his head violently. "I really don't. But for the sake of argument, just what the devil do you propose doing if the result, as you so casually put it, is female?"
She pursed her lips and turned her head to one side, considering. "Oh, I can think of a dozen things at least. The simplest would be for me to go abroad at the first suggestion of pregnancy. I should do that in any case, as we wouldn't be married yet, and pretend to be a wealthy widow. Then..."
William uttered a noise that he'd meant to be a laugh, and she raised a palm to suppress him, continuing serenely,
"And then, if the child were to be a girl, I should simply come back with the little darling, for I'm sure any child of yours would be adorable, William, and announce that a good friend of mine had died in childbed, and that I had adopted her daughter out of charity, of course, but also to give my darling Trevor a sister."
She lowered the palm and widened her eyes at him.
"That's one way. I can think of others if you..."
"Please don't." He didn't know whether to laugh, shout at her, eat a grape, or just leave. Before he could decide, she'd done her illusion again and was pressed lightly against him, her hands on his shoulders, face beguilingly turned up.
"But you see," she said reasonably, "there isn't really any risk, to you, I mean. And you might..."
Her hand cupped his cheek, brief and cool as rain, and her forefinger traced his lips.
"Just possibly enjoy it."
Chapter 47. Tacy is the Latin for a candle. John had known they'd have to talk about Percy, but he'd succeeded in avoiding Hal until the next day by the simple expedient of leaving his coat and gorget with Prevost's cook and going down to the harbour while Hal was still talking to old Bullethead. There he hired a boat to take him fishing in the marshes. His guide, a local by the name of La Pola, was very knowledgeable, and John came in after dark, smelling of mud and marsh grass, with a sack full of redfish and a large horrible thing called a horseshoe crab, which they had discovered, fortunately dead, on a tiny islet composed entirely of oyster shells. He had eaten some of his fish, broiled over a fire on the beach, and utterly delicious. Then, slightly drunk, he had stolen into Hal's room around midnight and left the dead crab on the bedside table beside his sleeping brother as a symbolic comment on the situation. What with one thing and another, though, he didn't encounter a conscious Hal until late the next afternoon, following a harrowing tea party at the home of a Mrs. Tina Anderson, who, while herself a tall, statuesque, blonde beauty possessed of great charm, was also possessed of a horde of chattering friends who had descended on him en masse, affectionately clinging to his sleeve or fingering his gold braid, while expressing their gratitude for the army's presence and their admiration of the courageous soldiers who were saving them, apparently, from mass rapine. "It was like being pecked to death by a flock of small parrots," he told Hal, "screeching and feathers everywhere." "Never mind parrots," Hal said shortly.
He'd been out himself to a more formal and doubtless less noisy gathering at the home of a Mrs. Roma Sars, where he'd talked to some of the politicals who'd been at Prévost's luncheon.
I was hoping to talk to Monsieur Soissons and find out how the devil bloody Percy comes to be here when he's supposed to be dead, or at least decently pretending to be. But Soissons wasn't in the way,
Hal replied shortly. He'd got his stock off, and the dark red mark across his neck suggested that he'd been choking back words of one kind and another all afternoon.
Where was it you said you'd met the fellow last?
John undid his own leather stock and closed his eyes, sighing with relief.
I met him at the American camp in a place called Coriel's Ferry, just before Monmouth. I told you about that.
Hal wiped his face with a discarded towel, evidently used previously for blacking boots, and tossed it into the corner.
And how the devil did he come to be there, for that matter?
John shook his head.
What did it matter now, after all?
Still, he wasn't going to explain just how it was that Percy had escaped being hanged for the crime of sodomy. He'd rather Hal didn't expire of apoplexy just yet.
About how you got yourself arrested by the Americans, escaped, and showed up after the battle in camp with a homicidal Mohawk Indian purporting to be James Fraser's nephew?
More or less, Hal said, and a corner of his mouth twitched.
Mostly less, I imagine. You didn't mention Percy, at any rate.
John blinked in a non-committal sort of way and tilted his head toward the door. Brisk footsteps were coming down the corridor, doubtless Hal's valet, coming to extract Hal from the bondage of his dress uniform. To his surprise, however, the footsteps belonged to William, mildly dishevelled but evidently sober.
I need to find Bannister Tarleton, he said without preamble. How do you suggest I do that?
What do you want him for? Hal inquired, sitting down in a wooden chair. And if you want help,
turnabout's fair play, help me get these bloody boots off. They're John's, and they're killing me. It's not my fault you've got bunions, John said. Totally fitting for an infantry commander, though, you'll admit. No one can say you don't do your job thoroughly.
Hal gave him a mildly evil look, then put his hands on William's head to brace himself as William wrestled one boot loose.
Do you know where Tarleton is? He asked John, who shook his head. Neither do I, Hal said, addressing the cowlick on top of William's head, which swirled neatly clockwise before sticking up.
Just like his father's, John thought.
Clinton's chief clerk would know, Gray said, and cleared his throat. His name's Ronson, Captain Geoffrey Ronson, if you please.
Fine. William jerked the boot off and nearly shot backward off the campaign chest he was sitting on. He tossed the muddy boot on the hearthrug and inspected his chest to be sure his beetles had suffered no damage.
Where the devil is Sir Henry keeping himself these days? New York for the moment, Hal said, sticking out his other foot. I'd bet reasonable money that Tarleton is still with him. Tarleton's cavalry riders were Clinton's new toy at Monmouth, and I doubt he's had all his fun with them yet.
William grunted as the second boot came off and laid it with its fellow on the rug.
So, shall I write to Tarleton directly, care of Sir Henry?
John and Hal exchanged glances.
I think I would, Hal said with a slight shrug. Just don't put anything in the letter that you don't want the world to know about. Some clerks are discreet, and a hell of a lot of them aren't. Speaking of which, John said, eyeing his son, would it be indiscreet of us to ask why you want to find Bannister Tarleton?
William shook his head, then smoothed the dislodged cowlick back into the dark mass of his hair.
Dennis Randall told me at the luncheon yesterday that it was Ban Tarleton who first got the letter from Middlebrook encampment about Ben dying there. He evidently gave it to Ezekiel Richardson, and thus...
He made a spiralling gesture indicating the letter's eventual arrival to Hal's hand.
So I want to know why Tarleton got it and how. Very reasonable,
Hal agreed,
but I doubt it'll be that easy.
He lowered his brows and stared at William very directly.
What I tell you goes no further, William. Not to your Indian friend, your lover, if you have one. And no, I don't want to know.
Or anyone else. William refrained from rolling his eyes, but only just. John looked down to hide a smile.
Tacy is the Latin for a candle, William said obligingly, and laid a hand over his mouth.
My lips are sealed. Hal snorted, but nodded.
Right. Sir Henry is tired of making feints at the Americans around New York and Virginia. He wants a bold stroke, and he's got his eyes upon Charlestown. If he hasn't already left New York to go take it from the Americans, he will within the next few months.
Who told you that? John asked, surprised.
3 different men at luncheon, all of whom begged me to keep it quiet.
I see what you mean about discretion, Uncle,
William said, openly amused.
I, said Hal coldly, am the colonel of His Majesty's 46th Regiment of Foot. You are...
His voice trailed off as he gazed at William, bareheaded and slightly rumpled in his civilian finery, but still with a straight-backed bearing of a soldier.
I don't suppose that will ever leave him, John thought. It hasn't left his father. Not a serving officer at the moment, Hal finished,
choosing to be tactful for once. William nodded agreeably.
That's fortunate, isn't it? He said. As you aren't my commanding officer, you can't forbid me to go look for Tarleton if I like.
Chapter 48 A Face in the Water.
Fanny and Cyrus sitting in a tree. K-I-S-S-I-N-G,
Roger said as he came into the surgery.
I laughed, but looked guiltily over my shoulder. They better not be. Jamie's roaming about like a wolf seeking whom he may devour.
Cyrus was a very tall, very thin lad from one of the fisher folk families, though I didn't know which one. He'd sat down next to Fanny at church one Sunday and had been appearing now and then near her like a tall, bashful ghost. I'd never heard him speak and wondered whether he had any English. Fanny's Gaelic was so far limited to commonplaces like Pass me a bannock, please, and the Lord's Prayer, but I suppose they might be of an age where young people are naturally tongue-tied in each other's presence.
They're not, Roger assured me. I just saw them on the creek bank sitting a decorous 2 feet apart. Cyrus, with his hands folded so tight in his lap that he must be cutting off the circulation. Who is Jamie seeking to devour, and why?
He got a letter from Benjamin Cleveland, signed by 2 other landowners, over the mountain in Tennessee County as well. They're pestering Jamie to commit his militia and come join them in rooting out the vile root of tyranny, which I take to mean going round the neighbours and, if they're loyalists, hauling them out and beating them, taking their stock, burning their buildings, hanging them, or doing other antisocial things to discourage them. Roger's laughter disappeared.
Mr. Cleveland's prose style leaves a bit to be desired, he said. Rooting out the root, I mean. But at least he's clear about it.
So is Jamie, I said, and resumed pounding the roots in my mortar with somewhat more force than necessary.
Meaning he's damned if he'll do it. But he can't just tell them to go directly to hell without passing go. If he did, the only thing stopping them from adding the ridge to their visiting list would be distance.
How far is it from here to Tennessee County? Roger asked, uneasy.
Some way, surely.
I stopped pounding long enough to shrug and wipe the forming sweat off my forehead with my sleeve.
Roughly 3 or 4 days' ride, with good weather. I added,
with a glance at the window, which showed sunshine streaming over the blooming grass.
And
There's Captain Cunningham and his loyalist friends to be considered too, I suppose.
Oh, God, I said. Yes, rather the local worm in the apple, isn't he? On the other hand, I added judiciously, he's probably Jamie's best excuse for not joining our friend Benjamin on his bloodthirsty rounds. The notion that Jamie has to stay here on the ridge in order to keep his own loyalists in line. Which might actually be true, come to think of it.
I suppose so. Why is that?
He asked, nodding at the mortar purely for distraction. Echinacea, I said. It's a bit early, but I need it. You dig the roots in autumn because that's when the plant starts storing its energy in the root. It doesn't need to keep flowers and leaves going. You realize, I added, pausing for breath, that distance notwithstanding, the only things keeping Nicodemus Partland's thugs, I mean it must be him, mustn't it, from going through the ridge like a dose of salts, are you and Jamie. Roger looked as though he wasn't surprised to hear that, but was still discomforted.
Aye, he said slowly, you can see it in Lodge. You know it's not done to talk politics or religion there. Equality, fraternity, etc.
So I've heard. I'd slowed down a little in my pounding and gave him a wry smile. I always assumed that was a custom more honoured in the breach, though. Knowing what people are like, I mean. Men, I meant, and he noticed, giving me back the wry smile. He tilted a hand to and fro in equivocation.
The lodge members mostly keep to the letter of the law there, but what happens in practice is that some men just stop coming if they got substantial differences.
I stopped pounding and looked at him. That's why Jamie always goes on Tuesdays. He staked the lodge out as his territory.
Yes and no. He's modest about it, but he is the worshipful master. And frankly, any place with him in it tends to be his territory.
That made me laugh, and I picked up a bottle of beer from the counter, took a swig, and offered it to him.
But, I said.
He nodded and took the bottle.
But, he encourages everyone to come regardless, and he keeps the peace in Lodge, where he can do it without it being overtly about politics. But, as you see, in the breach, men do talk. And even if they're not talking about politics, it's easy enough to tell who's who. And after a point, most of the committed loyalists stopped coming.
They're gathering at the captain's house, I guessed, and he nodded. That gave me a qualm. How many?
20 or so. Most of the ridge folk are on our side, though the larger part of them would really just rather be left alone and not be bothered.
I can't say I blame them, I said dryly. A high, thin scream came from the window and I turned sharply, but relaxed again almost at once. Mandy and Ori Higgins are collecting leeches for me with Fanny, I said, waving at the window. They keep putting them on each other. Speaking of that, I leaned back a little, looking him over. Were you looking for Jamie, or do you need medical attention? He smiled, recalled to his mission.
The latter. But it's no for me. I was just visiting the Chisholms, and as I was leaving, I stopped to talk to old Mum. She was sitting on a bench outside smoking her pipe, so I sat down and chatted a bit.
That must have been fun.
Well, up to a point. But then she told me that whenever she goes to the privy, her womb falls out into her hand. And would I ask you if there's anything to be done about it?
He flushed a little, and I stifled a laugh. Let me think that one over. I'll go up and talk to her tomorrow. Meanwhile, would you go fish Mandy and Ori out of the creek and find out if Cyrus is staying for supper? As he walked down toward the creek, he saw Jem, Germain, Aidan, and a few of the other boys from uphill carousing through the woods, brandishing sticks at each other, slashing them like swords and pretending to fire them as muskets, shouting, bang, at random intervals.
It's all fun and games until somebody loses an eye, he murmured,
hearing Mrs. Graham's admonition from his youth. No point in rounding up that lot and lecturing them, though. Beyond the fact that they were boys, there was a colder fact, too. Said boys were only a few years away from being able to ride with a militia or join the army. And the bloody war was heading in their direction fast.
1781, though, he said, and crossed his fingers. Yorktown happens in October of 1781. 2 bloody years. But only 2 bloody years.
Surely they could make it that far. The sight of Mandy and Orry in the creek, sopping wet, covered with mud and waterweed, and chattering happily as a pair of titmice, eased his mind a bit. And so did the sight of Fanny and Cyrus, who had now moved closer together. Cyrus, more than a foot taller than Fanny, was doing his best to arch over and look at what she was showing him without accidentally touching her. Roger cleared his throat, not wanting to startle them, and Cyrus snapped rigidly upright.
"It's all right, Aharich," Fanny told him, pronouncing Aharich very carefully and very wrongly.
Roger smiled and saw Cyrus do so too, though he tried to hide it.
"It's only Roger Mack."
"True," Roger said amiably, smiling down at them. "Mrs. Clare only wants to know, will you stay to dinner, Avalach?"
Cyrus had gone pink in the ears at being discovered so close to Fanny, and had in consequence lost all his English, but replied in Gaelic that he thanked the mistress and would like nothing better, but that his brother Hiram had told him to be back before nightfall, and it was a long walk.
"Aye, then. Ikva."
He noticed, as he turned away, that Fanny had brought out her small roll of personal treasures to show Cyrus. His eye caught the gleam of a pendant in the grass, and Fanny had her hand half-shielding an unfolded paper with some sort of drawing, as though to keep it from his eyes. Ah, must be the picture of her dead sister. Bree had described it to him. Cyrus must be well in with a chance, then, if Fanny was sharing that with the lad.
"Godspeed, Avalach,"
he said, mostly to himself, and smiled. Smiled not only out of a general benevolence toward the young lovers, but because Fanny's drawing had reminded him of the reason for that benevolence. Roger touched the pocket of his breeches, feeling the crackle of paper and the small hardness of the broken wax seal. It wasn't that he didn't believe it. He had, after all, been expecting it, or something like it. But there's a difference between thinking you understand something and then holding the reality in your hand and realizing that maybe you don't. But realizing also that what you don't yet understand may be the most important thing you ever do. A faint sound of screeching made him turn his head. Fatherly instincts at once focused. But Mandy's piercing complaint left off almost at once as she pushed Orry, who fell backward into the water, not for the first time.
"Well, maybe the second most important thing," he thought, smiling a little.
His adoptive father, who had been, in fact, his great-uncle, had been a Presbyterian minister and had never married, though ministers were allowed to marry and generally encouraged to do so, as their wives could be a help on the organizing side of a congregation. He'd never asked the Reverend why he hadn't married, nor had he ever wondered until now. Maybe it had been as simple as not meeting the right person, and being unwilling to settle for simple companionship. Maybe as simple as a feeling that it would be difficult to balance a commitment to God with a commitment to a wife and children.
"He gave me the wife and children."